Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the last FIIA webinar for 2016. I am your host, Adam Russo. With me, as always, is my good friend, our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
In addition, backed by popular demand, is one of our great staff attorneys who is our political junkie here at FIIA, Brady C. Bizarro. Say hello, Brady.
Hello.
And visiting us from the City of Magic, here today for the entire week, getting ready for our big Christmas party. Yes, we call it a Christmas party here, FIIA. Sorry, Ron.
I forgive you.
This Friday night happening at 7 o'clock, open bar. So any client that wants that's going to be in town, feel free to come by. Actually, I probably shouldn't have said that, huh?
No, now we got to
top shelf alcohol. Anyways, with us to talk about the compliance and regulatory changes for 2017 is the Miss Personality, Miss Outgoing, Kelly Dempsey. Say hello, Kelly.
Hello.
And just want to say something really quick to all of you people, the hundreds of people that are with us actually today, is over 10,000 people have seen our webinars this year, and we're very proud of that fact, and we're expecting that next year will be even better. We plan a full slate of webinars as well next year. We actually have a new person here at FIIA who's going to be helping us with all of our social media, all of our external marketing and publications and so forth, so we're expecting some really innovative stuff. So you won't see these boring templates anymore starting next year. We've been told that our newsletter, even though it has great content, basically is using a format from Windows 96. So we're going to try to upgrade all those things. But with that, as always, folks, please feel free to email us at PGCreferral for all your consulting needs. I talk to all of you about this every single month. We get about a couple thousand every month, just random questions and emails and just people comment to us on our services, what they like, what they don't like, etc. As always, you have that question box where you can send us questions. We will try to answer the relevant questions at the end if we have time. Otherwise, we promise, as always, to reach out to you after the webinar. And yes, before you start questioning, this will be recorded and it will be available on our website immediately after today's presentation is over. Okay, let's turn it over to Kelly. If you wouldn't mind talking about what were November's most frequently asked questions in the month of November. If you share that information and give us some detail on that, that'd be great. Kelly?
I'm going to go a little bit out of order on this one, and I'm going to start with the marketplace appeals. So one of the most common questions we're getting is that employers are receiving letters from the marketplace that are granting employees a subsidy, and the employers are confused because the plan coverage is affordable, it meets minimum value, and employers are not knowing what to do next and where to go. Unfortunately, if you've experienced it thus far, the marketplace appeals process is not a robust process. There's only one level of appeal, and we very commonly have seen a follow-up request for more information after the employer submits an appeal, but it's not really clear on what the marketplace is actually looking for in order for an employer to succeed. So unfortunately, we haven't seen a very high success rate when employers have sent in appeals. So it's not great, but again, the good news is that the marketplace isn't the one that's actually issuing any sort of penalty under the employer mandate. Those specific penalties are going to come from the IRS. So what we do know right now is the IRS will have an appeals process. What we don't know, surprisingly enough, is what that process is going to entail. So, you know, stay tuned for that. As soon as we learn what the process is, when the penalties start coming out, we'll obviously help you with any of those appeals. It's estimated that there are $32 billion of penalties that will be issued. Unfortunately, we don't think it's likely that any penalties will be issued before the end of the first quarter of 2017. Obviously, the change in administration is obviously probably going to play into that. So, obviously, if you have any questions with appeals, if you have employers that are getting marketplace appeals, you don't know what to do, it's important to reach out to us at the very beginning. The sooner you get to us, the sooner we can help and figure out what the best process and response should be. So the next question we're going to go to is the ACA Section 1557 and dependent pregnancy. So we've gotten a lot of questions recently about whether 1557 impacts a self-funded plan's ability to maintain an exclusion for excluding dependent child maternity services. As we know, prior to the ACA, there was no requirement for a self-funded plan to cover maternity services for dependent children. Unfortunately, since 1557 was passed and published, we've seen lawsuits popping up about sex discrimination in this context.
Can you explain what that means to, you know, our lay people out there? What do you mean people are obviously filing lawsuits, and what are they basing it on?
Well, that's exactly where I'm going next.
Oh, great.
So the National Women's Law Center has filed 5 lawsuits, Alabama, Ohio, Indiana, Washington State, and Pennsylvania. These lawsuits are all claiming sex discrimination for the fact that the female dependent children aren't being offered these services. That's the basis of these claims. The claims, interestingly enough, are against a couple universities and a couple health systems, which, as we know, are covered entities under 1557. So it seems like the National Women's Law Center has strategically picked the locations of these, as well as the type of employers that they're going after, because what's very interesting, and from, you know, legal perspective, these 5 cases are all in different federal circuits, meaning if the different courts find different ways on these cases, it gives the Supreme Court the ability to review and determine and settle the conflict between the circuits. So we're definitely watching these lawsuits and seeing how they, they're at the very beginning stages. It's unlikely that they're going to be litigated fully for some time now, but we're definitely monitoring those and watching those to see where they go next.
What are the tea leaves telling you in regards to these cases? What do you think is going to happen?
It's really hard to say,
I know it's hard to say, that's why we're asking the question.
I don't know. I think it's very likely that they'll come up with some sort of conflict between the districts. I think, the more conservative areas may find that these services may have to be covered, whereas, more liberal areas may say that they don't have to be covered, and, it's anyone's guess as to what the Supreme Court would do after that. It may depend on, who's sitting on the Supreme Court when the case finally reaches there.
So basically, it's a wait and see. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions on it.
Unfortunately, I know you guys have been hearing that for probably the last 7 years, and unfortunately, I can't say that I'm going to stop saying that anytime soon. So, the analysis on these cases is very similar to the transgender services, but there's not really a specific what has to be covered versus what doesn't have to be covered in the regulations. It's just that any categorical exclusion could be viewed as sex discrimination. So, it's important to have plain language that matches your intent. So the last question is coverage or exclusion for a covered member who is also a surrogate. So basically, plans generally should not exclude services that are otherwise covered. So if maternity services and prenatal care are otherwise covered, it would be probably just seem discriminatory for someone who is a surrogate and also an employee enrolled in the plan just because they're a surrogate to not have those claims be covered. So, that's kind of the standard rule. If there is an exclusion for infertility treatment specifically, the impregnation of that member would likely not have to be covered. But again, plan language is very, very important here to make sure it's clear as to what's covered and what's not covered.
Hey, we have a question, Kelly. Would you repeat those states again in regards to the dependent pregnancy?
Alabama, Ohio, Indiana, Washington State, and Pennsylvania.
And the next thing was, what would you recommend our clients doing at this point?
At this point in time, it's kind of a wait-and-see game. I don't necessarily think for the dependent pregnancy that plans should jump on it and take action.
Basically, we're stuck on the plan.
Yeah.
If we felt that, we don't need to. So the bottom line is right now at this point, we don't need to cover it.
Yeah.
If we choose to, that's our own decision. But at this point in time, we can choose to not cover a child's pregnancy.
Correct.
Because, obviously this could happen now that we have coverage up to 26, right?
Yeah.
So clearly, but this is just an employer decision, like anything else. If you want to offer this coverage, great, but it's not required, it's not mandated, and then we'll have to see if that changes based on one of these court cases.
Correct. And, we'll get into this in a couple later slides, but the big issue of whether or not you decide to cover it or not cover it is knowing what your risks are. If you're not directly subject to 1557, you may not be subject to the rules specifically, but there's always the potential for, an employee to file a lawsuit against you and the EEOC to get involved. And again, we'll dig into that a little bit more.
And one of our favorite FIA, we call them, FIA fanatics here, one of our favorite ones from Texas, has a question saying, what if the surrogate is getting paid? I'm assuming all surrogates, well, not all, but many surrogates get paid, right? Like a family member, maybe.
It depends. Many state laws actually say that you can't compensate individuals for being a surrogate. So there is the opportunity for subrogation. We do have subrogation cases where we subrogate,
right.
If there is a surrogacy situation. But specifically, I'm referring to the coverage for the actual maternity services and prenatal services.
We just said, folks in the audience, we already have 18 questions about just these 3 little topics. So obviously, we can see why it is a frequently asked question for the month of November. again, feel free to email us at ptcreferral@cgroup.com, but we have to make sure we keep on going. We have a lot of stuff to cover in about 45 minutes.
So I'll wrap up on this one. Basically, the moral of the story is I can kind of tie this back into 1557. We haven't seen a lawsuit yet that says there's any sort of sex discrimination for not covering surrogacy, you know, and services related to that under this, but there's always the potential for that to come up. So again, you can always generally address these surrogacy situations under subrogation, and we're at this point wait and see game with monitoring how 1557 is going to impact these things.
Great, great job, Kelly. As always, folks, we have that LinkedIn and Twitter contest. Post or tweet honest feedback about how badly you think Ron did today. Let us know at the FIA group on LinkedIn or on Twitter, and potentially win 1 hour free consultative guidance on any issue, including those that Kelly just brought up. And as always, just so you know, we have a new gentleman here by the name of Derek Mish, who's going to be handling all of our external media. So if you notice some of the new things that we have on LinkedIn and on Twitter, it's basically due to a lot of his involvement. Now, really quick, I want to give all of our clients a quick update. You will be getting a email and be contacted by your client account manager. We have a major reporting portal update. Basically, all of our status reports now, instead of being monthly ones, they're literally on demand. Everything is pretty much live. This is a huge undertaking for us, both on our historical overview reports and our normal status reports. You now have updates constantly. So if you want to know what's going on with any particular case at any given time, you can go on our portal. Feel free to contact Marta, and her last name is Butkiewicz, by the way. I know I speak Polish, so it's hard for people, but, well, I speak the language, Ron. At the end of the day, feel free to contact Marta in our accounting department. She can schedule a personalized training session. But we're also going to be having a webinar for our clients on Wednesday, January 4th. You could go on our website and get more information on that, or just reach out to Marta directly. It's just another example of our serious investment in IT infrastructure here at FIA. We've put a lot of resources in that from our FIA system, and now we have moved that along into our reporting portal as well. Okay, let's get into the overview of the 2017 FIA forecast. Folks, I wish we could all sit here and tell you exactly what's going to happen in 2017, but we can tell you that we just did the Donald Trump first 100 days webinar, I think, 3 weeks ago. A lot's changed in those 3 weeks. So we expect even more to happen. Remember, he's not even the president yet, right? And this, it's almost like Obama should just like take a vacation early, because I don't think anyone even knows that he's actually president anymore. But the point is, we're going to talk about a lot of this stuff. Upcoming regulatory changes, out-of-pocket maximums, SBCs, audits, standalone HRAs, etc. We're going to talk about the presidential transition. Brady is our guru on that. We're going to talk about the recap from last time and what the current status is. Again, now it was repeal and replace. Now it's a delay. And last but not least, what we are expecting.
All right, so first up, we have, obviously, the out-of-pocket maximums have increased for 2017. So these are the new ones, $7,150 for individual and $14,300 for family. Again, those are the ceiling limits for out-of-pocket maximums for plans that are subject, obviously, to ACA. So next is, you know, everybody's favorite topic, because it's actually going to be here sooner rather than later. The SBC regulations are getting closer to taking effect. The new template and materials and all these regulations and rules changes are effective for the first day of open enrollment that begins on or after April 1st, 2017. If the plan doesn't have open enrollment, it's going to be the first plan year on or after April 1st, 2017. So that is what's there. We obviously are working with this template and have identified all the different areas that have changed. You know, some are more subtle than others. But this next bullet talks about the specific things that have changed, including the embedded deductible language. There's significantly more language and variables associated with embedded deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums. So that whole first page of the SBC is looking a little bit different than it used to.
Hey, real quick, Kelly. Sorry for interrupting you again. I'll probably keep doing this. That's what I do, right? What about those people that say, why do we need to follow any of these regulations? Now that Trump's in power, or he's going to be in power in a few weeks, do these SBC regulations matter? Like, what's going to happen if I just leave everything alone and not change anything? Is there an argument that he made that no one's actually going to follow the regulations, or these rules will be in place, but there's not going to be any enforcement mechanism to make sure it happens? Or is that separate from, I mean, we still get questions from people asking us if we can just go back to the pre-Obamacare days based on the fact that they're expecting all of it to be, well, repealed eventually. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, as a self-funded plan, obviously you have the discretionary authority to do whatever you wish, and you can fly obviously in a reasonable fashion. You know, there are the untalked about and forgotten about penalty that is the self-reported penalty under the ACA that is an excise tax. It's $100 a day per impacted individual. That's, you know, a random penalty that plans forget about. And, you know, if the DOL is obviously ramping up audits, you know, we've seen a lot of information that's come out with the DOL looking at specific things like mental health parity and things like that. So the audits aren't stopping.
So you the people out there that are thinking that we don't need to do anything, they're being foolish because, if anything, the audits are increasing.
I agree. That would be a fair statement to me.
If anything, the law is the law, Adam. The law is the law, and if you think of it this way, let's say a lot of people have the philosophy that you've shared, which is that this is a lame duck president. We think that the current administration is going to remove the law, so let's ignore it. This is that sweet spot when auditors are more likely to find people who are violating, and if nothing else, it's a capital grab. This is a great opportunity to find violators and charge them. So now is probably the best time to be in compliance.
I agree. So going back to the specific changes, there's some additional changes to the maternity description. They increased the line items to break it down further with respect to maternity benefits. And to change the lines again, they've combined mental health parity or mental health and substance abuse benefits. They've reduced those line items from 4 to 2. So that's very important. There's also, you know, additional example, the coverage examples on the end. There is fracture with ER and follow-up care. And there's some additional variables that apply to all of the coverage examples. There is a new rule for SBCs that are provided electronically. HHS is going to provide a hyperlink so that you can hyperlink the different definitions for the terms that are used on the SBC. The embedded hyperlink is not required, but obviously it won't work if you send them out in paper copies. But if you do, you know, electronic distribution of your SBCs and you're interested in doing the hyperlinks, you're able to do that. And then the ancillary documents that go with the SBC template, such as the coverage calculator and the instruction guide, have both been updated. As we all know, unfortunately, the minimum value calculator has not been updated. It's kind of anyone's guess at this point as to why they're not updating it. If your out-of-pocket maximum is over the limit that can be calculated using the minimum value calculator, there are other methods to calculate it, and you need to take advantage of those. So the next new thing, which is actually expected to be signed at 2 o'clock this afternoon by the president, so coming up very shortly, is this new standalone rules for HRAs for small employers. A couple of very interesting things to note. The definition of small employer here is the definition aligns with the employer mandate. So employers with 2 to 249 employees employed. So it's the employer mandate rules for figuring out who is a small employer. They will determine that these HRAs are not group health plans, therefore they're not subject to ERISA or the Affordable Care Act, and all of the lovely rules, which is obviously contrary to the popular guidance or prior guidance that we've been given. There are a couple different thresholds that it sets, and that the maximum reimbursement payment under the plan for individuals is $4,950. And if you reimburse family expenses, you can go up to $10,000. This rule wouldn't be effective until plan years that start in 2017, so it's obviously coming up. You have to obviously provide the same terms for all employees. The very interesting thing that's in here that is not up on this slide is that if you you are only allowed to comply with this and be found to have this standalone HRA if you don't offer a health plan to your employees. So I think they've narrowed the class of employers that significantly, because, you know, most small employers still do offer some sort of coverage for their employees. So I think that's an important thing to know and see on this. So, again, the rules are supposed to be signed this afternoon, so if anything changes from, you know, significantly from where it's at, we'll let you know. And back to everyone's popular, you know, questions about 1557 and the non-discrimination rule. So we talked a little bit about this before, but the issue here is the scope of 1557 is obviously very limited. It's a very limited set of who it actually applies to, but the other issue is the threat of EEOC litigation. The EEOC is obviously, can go after any employer, not necessarily just the employers that are subject to 1557. So if an employee files a claim of discrimination and the EEOC gets involved, There's still a risk of litigation, and you know, there's no specific damages that are out there. It would be determined on a case-by-case basis based on whatever is happening with that specific individual. So there is potential impact to you know, preventive services like we talked about and maternity care, specifically where it says IE for females. The issue here is that obviously the services that are available to somebody should be those are that medically necessary and appropriate for that individual. So, for example, if you have somebody that is registered on the plan as a male, but they do not physically have a prostate exam is obviously not going to be medically necessary for them. So you have to cover these services that are appropriate for that specific individual and pay attention to those on a case-by-case basis. And the maternity claims, obviously we talked about this with excluding dependent daughters, goes back to the FAQ. I did see a question that popped up about if you exclude dependent daughters, maternity services, do you have to cover the preventive care? If you are a non-grandfather plan and you have to cover the preventive care services in line with the ACA rules, yes, you need to cover the prenatal preventive care services that apply to that dependent child. So you cannot distinguish preventive services based on whether or not they're a dependent daughter or a spouse. So moving along to the next one, obviously the notice requirements for 1557 are already in effect. They went into effect in mid-October. There was a caveat for employers that are obviously providing, you know, different types of handouts. They were allowed to use whatever stock they had already there. So if you have letterhead and things that are already there, you didn't have to change them. But obviously, if you need to comply with the notice requirements, you better get on that. And then the SPD plan document changes. The rules technically go into effect for health plans as of the first plan year on or after January 1st, 2017. So if you're gearing up for open enrollment and you're afraid that your plan is non-compliant, you know, obviously you can send us the questions and we can help you review the language if you need to.
Interesting point here. So it's funny. Ron Brady and myself have spent a lot of time on updating our FIA SPD for 2017. So folks out there, if you actually use our PDM software, you'll notice we put a bunch of great additions. And then we went back and updated our handbook. What we never realized is the amount of gaps potentially between the SPD and the handbook. It's gotten to a point where it was so scary. I mean, I don't know how many weeks have we worked on this? About a month almost now? Yeah. Of identifying gaps in state and federal laws versus what our SPD says versus what our handbook says. It's so incredible. We actually might do a webinar topic just on that gap alone because it's so pervasive. So one of the things I would urge many of you, we've been doing this for a long time. We still had gaps that we were unaware of. Just based on because they weren't necessarily tied to health insurance,
right.
Other things. So it's definitely something that you need to be aware of, especially now as your SPDs are getting a lot more detailed with a lot more information that you may not even realize affect your actual handbook and what it actually says from a coverage standpoint. So you may start covering something in your handbook that you don't cover, that's not covered in your SPD, and therefore a stop loss wouldn't reimburse you on. So just wanted to bring that up.
All right. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Kelly. This is Ron. Hey, everybody. So I'd like to first start by commenting on the number of questions and comments that are popping up in our chat box here. Feel free to keep them coming. You know, I can only speak for myself, but I'm a little overwhelmed by the amount of enthusiasm people are showing right now regarding the plethora of topics we've been talking about. Again, we're going to try and cover the subjects, the topics as they come up, address your questions as part of the conversation. For those questions that are a little bit ancillary, what we will try to do, if we don't get to them today, is respond back to you. But, of course, if you feel like we brought something up that you want to talk to us about, there's some dialogue that you'd like to get going, there's an issue or an outstanding question that you have, as always, reach out to us. Our contact information will be provided at the end of the presentation. These questions enable us to really evolve and develop our own services and offerings, so we welcome them. But again, there are a lot of questions up there right now, so if we don't get to it, don't get frustrated. We will get to them eventually. As far as some of the things that we're seeing for 2017, you know, the first thing that I want to talk about, and Adam and Kelly sort of touched upon this already, is the rumor of audits. And the thing is, you know as well as I that around the holidays, you know that the police are out in force. They're looking for speeders. They're looking for drunk drivers. People that are involved in enforcement of law, they know those times when people are most likely to violate those rules and those laws. And right now, when we're between administrations and people are doubting, oh, you know, they're going to get rid of this law anyway. There's no point in complying with it. There's no point in making changes to be in compliance with this law if this law is going to be gone in a year. That's when they get you. The point is, if you were to take a freeze frame today and ask yourself, what is the law of the land today? That is the law in which you must be compliant. Do not assume that things are going to be removed. Because you might recall, there were assumptions, I remember this, after President Obama's first term, when everybody thought he was going to lose re-election and that Mitt was going to win, and people thought, oh, he's going to get rid of it, no problem. And when President Obama won, they said, oh, man, we were, you know, postponing getting in compliance with Obamacare because we didn't think that he was actually going to win re-election and that we'd have to do it. And everybody scrambled to get compliant as quick as possible.
We still get those questions now.
Still get those same questions now. So, again, don't make the same mistake. Look at what the state of the law is today and be in compliance. Some of the sort of triggers that people are talking about, concern regarding increased enforcement and audits, you see things, for instance, regulators talking about how they want to change the rules regarding 5,500 filing and how they want small groups, groups with less than 100 participants, to start looking into filing 5,500. Now, they say they want to do this because they want to collect more robust data regarding self-funding, the success that plans are having, and in particular the success of small self-funded groups. But, you know, again, people look at that and say, ah, no, they want me to fill out a 5,500 because they want to get me. I know they're looking for information. The same way they have you file information regarding your plan when you file your taxes. You know, they say they're not looking to induce additional taxes, but people say, well, then why do you need this information? So they're collecting additional information. There's got to be a reason for it. Be careful and make sure you're in compliance with all the rules and regulations. Other things to look for. People are getting savvy regarding self-funding, cost containment, because they're required to do so. Plan participants, employers, they're asking questions. They're looking to advisors to give them information. It kind of has the same feel when people start to look inward at their 401ks, their pension plans, and they were saying, hey, you know, I think that my account was mismanaged. You know, who's the fiduciary? Who's responsible to take care of us? Who's responsible to protect us? The same way people got savvy about those investments years ago, I think that they're starting to get more savvy about their benefit plans, their health plans today.
Well, Ron, you say they're getting more savvy, but I just got in front of me a letter dated 2016 regarding the first two topics in your list. I mean, literally, I just opened it while you were talking. It's a letter from a law firm in Texas, and it's in regards to a client of ours who, well, not a client. Well, they're a client of ours, but when they put this together, it wasn't using us. Tied to carve-outs and RBP. The plan, I mean, the TPA is being sued for almost $4.5 million for underpayment of claims. Tied to the fact that people walked in with the in-network ID card. They had a carve-out within their plan design. The carve-out tied into RBP. Yet these were still in-network facilities, and the people had ID cards. Again, these things that people think are 2015, 2016, I just got the letter now demanding $4.6 million in payment within 30 days. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know a lot of TPAs that can write a check for $4.6 million. So the point being is, these are the kinds of issues. It's great. It's innovative. But if you want to do a carve-out, if you want to do reference-based pricing, you want to replace your RAP, you need to get an objective third party's opinion, like ours, in regards to the program that you want to put in place, so that you don't get one of these letters the week before Christmas. I mean, that's what we're trying to talk about. I mean, this is an exact example of what we should not be doing going into 2017, but still obviously happening.
And that proves my point right there, is that employers, employees, and the lawyers are becoming more savvy. They know what we're doing. You can't operate in the dark any further. So you need to be prepared to defend your actions and show that you've crossed all your T's, dotted all your I's. I actually have a note right here on my printout of these slides, and I wrote, "For where are the lawyers?" And this, I think, is proof of that. So what other market trends are we starting to see besides people getting sued for trying to be innovative at it?
A bunch of questions came in regards to captives. Yeah, captives is a big market trend right now. We're hearing a lot about people asking if these small employers, we work with captives. Captives, there's no question, it's probably the buzzword for 2016, how was the word captive. We're seeing larger and larger captive associations, more popping up. They seem to be very successful.
especially those that are, you know, picky in regards to who they allow in, and identify those groups they want to stay away from in regards to sharing that potential risk. So I would say that's definitely a trend and one that we're getting a lot of questions on.
Sure. Ron? Speaking of, you know, providers and attorneys, like I said, starting to get savvy to what we're doing and really sort of tightening the belt and fighting back, I actually recently I was listening to the radio on the way home, and they reported that, I think it was Mass General, reported a loss. Again, I don't know how they calculate these things. That was equal to the amount of the profit gains that they had seen the year prior. And the justification that they gave for the loss was that they were being undercompensated by Medicare as well as private payers. So this is definitely a topic that is on sort of the front burner for all of these providers, their attorneys. If employers feel like they're suffering pain due to these activities, they're going to potentially turn on us as well. So the thing, again, is to make sure that you're being careful, intelligent with all of your activities. Everything is defensible. If you're going to implement a cost containment measure, that it's defended by the plan as well as law and done properly, so that if someone does look at you and say, hey, what are you doing? How are you doing it? How are you allowed to do this? You can defend yourself and win. In addition to that, individual appeals. People have the right to an external appeal. And the fact of the matter is, if an individual plan participant, their claim is not being paid, that participant doesn't care. It's the provider who is expecting to get the check that cares. You don't think that that provider is going to use that participant as a tool. You don't think they're going to balance bill that participant to turn them against their employer in the plan. You don't think they're going to tell that participant that they have the right to an external appeal with an IRO. Of course they are. So as people start to understand these rights, they're going to use these participants against us, and they're going to pursue these rights. So you need to be prepared to deal with these types of appeals as they come in, including decision-making, like I said, crossing your T's, dotting your I's, ensuring that every decision you make is defended both by the plan language and the facts before you, and that you won't eventually, as a fiduciary, be exposed to liability because you made a mistake when you assessed the claim and the appeal. In addition to that, when you look at potentially implementing alternatives to network pricing, you hear a lot about RBP, Medicare Plus. It works for some. It's not right for others, but there is middle ground. There's a whole spectrum of things you can do. You know, a lot of people could start just by revisiting how they treat their out-of-network claims, revisit their use of things like RAP networks. So don't just assume that it's all or nothing. There is a spectrum that you need to consider, and you need to be careful when you do these things because, like I said 1,000 times already, employers, employees, providers, and attorneys, they're starting to look at what we're doing and really question the procedures.
Ready? All right, so we should return now to the Trump transition. As Adam mentioned, only been a few weeks since our last webinar, but already we've seen a lot has been happening in the transition. One of the themes that we've noticed, and I'm sure many of you have, is that many of the picks that Trump has made for his cabinet are basically business leaders. So everyone from just today, he announced the Secretary of State pick to be a guy from ExxonMobil.
Right.
He's announced his Secretary of Treasury is a former Goldman Sachs guy. Secretary of Labor is a fast food executive. These are all people that are prominent in the business world. And to my mind, this reinforces the signal that Trump intends to deregulate. He wants to pick people that are going to follow his idea that for every two regulations or every one regulation that's imposed, you've got to repeal two. And for our industry, the most important pick he's made so far has been for HHS. And that pick is Georgia Congressman Tom Price. And so we want to talk a little bit about his background, and we can get some idea of where we think he might take the cabinet and department next year. First of all, he is a huge critic of the ACA, and he's a former doctor. In fact, his father and grandfather were also doctors, so it's no surprise that many of the things that he supports are actually things that he advocates on behalf of doctors. His record suggests that he would try to reduce regulations on healthcare providers in particular. One of the first bills that he drafted and introduced into Congress was an ACA repeal bill, and it was called the Empowering Patients First Act. This bill, if he had had his way, would have removed the employer mandate, the individual mandate, and he would have rolled back Medicaid expansion. He also would have eliminated the exchanges, and it's funny to see that years later now, some of these ideas are coming back in the Trump administration. So he'll be heading a department that has $1 trillion in spending. It oversees the FDA. And so it's a big deal. So as you can see, he tried to block efforts as well by Medicare, excuse me, to scale back payments for providers. So the theme in a lot of what Representative Price is proposing is that he wants to protect providers, but he also has talked about transparency, which is good. He, like Mr. Trump, is an advocate of expanding the use of HSAs, which you mentioned last time, and some of the bills that he's proposed also would allow insurers to sell policies across state lines.
Hey, so Brady, can you go back to that last bullet?
Sure.
And expand on that a little bit?
Which one was
that? Blocking efforts by Medicare to scale back payments. So one of the big issues that most self-funded employers have is the less Medicare pays, someone else has to pick up the tab, right?
What the facilities tell us.
Right. So the facilities tell us that the Medicare pays less means private payers have to pay more. So self-funded employers pay more. So it seems like what you're telling us is he's actually for facilities and providers getting paid correctly, justly.
That's right.
By Medicare, which would then obviously limit or lessen the burden that the private employees would have to take on. Is that what you're saying?
Right, yeah. That's what the things he's introduced in Congress seem to indicate that. So part of what's happening with Medicare is we've seen a push to transition from fee-for-service models of care, and Price has sort of indicated that, no, doctors should be paid on a per-service basis. So as you mentioned, Adam, in this case here, it would actually – it would lead to more spending on the Medicare side by the government, which would be, you know, for the taxpayer, not necessarily a good thing, but for private payers, we could expect that Medicare would be, under his proposal, picking up more of the tab on that issue. But we can expect that Price will certainly lead the charge for the ACA repeal. But as Adam mentioned earlier, things aren't going quite as smoothly on that front as we initially thought. So one of my favorite politicians is a guy, Mario Cuomo, who was the former governor of New York, and he had a quote, which was campaign and poetry govern in prose. And to my mind, that seems to be what's going on here with the transition from repeal and replace to now repeal and delay. It turns out that it's actually pretty difficult to immediately dismantle one of the most complicated laws in American history. It took over 4 years and still counting to implement the ACA, so to remove it is actually pretty complicated. So when we combine that with the fact that recent polling by the Kaiser Foundation shows that at least two of the ACA provisions are very popular, namely the extension of dependent coverage up to age 26 and the guaranteed issue for people with pre-existing conditions, it's no surprise that we're now seeing a switch in tone here to repeal and delay.
I read somewhere that some of the people that actually talked about voting for Trump like Obamacare. Like more and more people seem to, now that it's almost gone, it's like that girlfriend that you almost break up with, you sort of like her again after you break up for a week. Is that what's happening? It seems like the public perception is they like the ACA a little bit more than they did when they thought it was going to be here forever. Once they thought it was going to be here forever, they didn't like it. Now that they voted to get rid of it, now they want it back?
I think that's right, Adam. I mean, as you mentioned last time, some of the parts of the law are popular. So when you have, you know, people like the extension of coverage to people up to age 26, people like the fact that insurers can't just ban coverage for you if you have a pre-existing condition. And, you know, those are not surprisingly costly parts of the law. So we mentioned in the last webinar we had a graph up that showed what people liked about the law and what they knew about the law. And it turns out people don't like the mandates, right, that you have to obtain coverage. People don't like the employer mandate, but they do like the coverage extensions, which causes a problem, as we can see, for Republicans, because how do you keep whatever replaces Obamacare as affordable? And so the idea now that was announced by the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, was to repeal now and delay the implementation of that repeal for either 2 or 3 years.
Meaning what?
Meaning,
how does that affect our clients?
Well, so it's in a big way because it's really a high-stakes deadline where Republicans have to come up with something to replace the ACA to get enough votes. But in the meantime, it really creates a lot of uncertainty. And for our industry, that's really important. Knowing the rules of the game is essential. If you can't predict exactly which laws and regulations are going to apply in the future, it's hard for a business or any company to invest or to expand. And so this is really going to cause a lot of disruption in the markets, and that's why you've seen, at least in the news media, a lot of criticism of this repeal and delay tactic.
So basically, it's a repeal just for political purposes, but the repeal doesn't actually happen until some later date, when they figure out what's going to replace it. So instead of just doing nothing, coming up with a plan, they're going to say that we're going to repeal it right now, but to delay its, what's the word?
Implementation
of the delay?
Yep.
So saying like, all right, we broke up today, but I'm actually not going to move out for like 3 years.
Right.
That's accurate. That's right? I mean, people are already emailing us. My wife and I are fine.
Yeah.
We have no issues. I'm actually getting a bunch of questions. Everything's great. We're going to wait till after the holidays are over. I'm kidding. Everything's fine. No, but is that what you're saying, though? Like, this is going to be repealed. We're repealing it, but nothing's changing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of this is politics, right? So the promise was made on the campaign trail to immediately repeal the law. And so it's sort of a clever way to say,
replace it with something.
Right. And the problem is that something hasn't really been created in full yet. Like I mentioned before, there are parts of the law that people like that are not really in line with congressional Republican priorities, the extension of coverage, for example, the costly parts of the law. And so it's not so easy for the transition administration and for Congress to come up with a replacement. They realize this is going to take a long time. And so they've effectively created for themselves a kind of Obamacare cliff. Some of our listeners may remember the fiscal cliffs from a few years ago where after this date, you know, something bad would happen. Well, if after the date they set for the repeal passes and nothing is in place, you're gambling with a big issue here, namely with the health care of millions of Americans. So we expect that, you know, we'll hear more. I think they'll fill in the details about what they will do in terms of a gap measure, if you will. But for now, the mantra is repeal and delay.
But from our client standpoint, they should just, and Kelly, maybe this is just to you, they should just go forward as if everything's staying the same based on what we're hearing.
That's what I would do.
Right. It's the best advice because, as I said, you know, there are parts of the law that Trump has said that he liked and that people like, and so we can bet that parts of the ACA will definitely remain in place. The other problem here is that there's not party-wide consensus on this, and so some Republican senators have said that they don't like the idea of repeal and delay because, it's politically toxic. As I mentioned, it's uncertain for business, and you have 20 million or so Americans that could lose coverage if total repeal happens. And so the bottom line here is that uncertainty is never a good thing for business, and the political fallout is a real thing on this issue. The other thing here to note is, so interest groups were at first pretty quiet after Trump won election. Lobbyists from provider groups and the insurance lobby was pretty quiet, but now they're starting to come forward, and they're making noise about what they want to see happen in a post-ACA world. And they're also warning that if regulators get this wrong, things could become a lot worse. And so I've just identified a few things that insurers have said that they'd like to see happen with whatever eventually replaces Obamacare. So one of them is an expanded risk payment to offset the cost of care. And so you may remember there was a high risk pool subsidy provided to certain businesses who took on very sick enrollees, and that was phased out. Of course, insurers would like to see that brought back because it would help offset the cost of care for very sick risk pools. They also want to see it harder for people to sign up for coverage outside of the open enrollment periods because we don't want to see a situation where people are only seeking coverage when they get sick because that's going to be very costly, obviously. If we have enrollment periods, then it'll help balance out the risk pool. And finally, on this point...
So in that situation...
Yep, sorry. Go for it.
If someone is sick and they didn't sign up, they would definitely then, therefore, not have insurance.
Right. They'd have
to. And then they go to the emergency room.
Correct.
And we're back into the same situation of why they started the exchanges in the first place.
That's right. So emergency care is very costly, as we know, and that would be what would happen eventually there. But the idea is that if you do let someone wait till they get sick to sign up, then one's going to get coverage.
But then that cost is borne by the hospital, and the hospital has to offset that cost by billing more to the private insurers.
Right.
So they're paying for it either way.
It's kind of a lose-lose on this issue. I agree on that. And the final point they've made is they like to prevent providers and other groups from steering patients into the individual market when they could qualify for Medicaid. So this is an example of where the Medicaid expansion, which again is in question when the Trump team takes over, it's obvious that insurers would like to see, they'd like to have more enrollees. And so if people could qualify for Medicaid, you know, put them on the Medicaid rolls, and the state bears the cost of those sick enrollees. And so all these points that these insurers are now making noises about are things that they see there's a void here, they see there's going to be a repeal, and they figure that if they can make their positions known early, they'll be listened to. It's, of course, of note here that President-elected Trump, receives very few contributions from lobbying industries in general. So to the extent that he's affected by these opinions remains to be seen. But they're certainly making noises about this stuff early on.
Just quick noting, yesterday's New York Times, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would move to repeal the ACA right after January 1st, but declined to give a timeline for a plan to replace it. Even though he was asked repeatedly, he did not give any timeline at all as to when Republicans would offer their own plan, just said that they would be consulting with different stakeholders.
Right. And so that essentially, as I said, essentially means that they don't have a plan in place yet.
Okay.
And that sort of jives well with the next slide here, Adam, which is what is likely to happen? From our point of view here, the earliest action and things we've been reading, likely in February. Obviously, the president-elect will take office in late January. And there's a quick feeling here, though, in the House of Representatives that they want to get this done now. There's a take-no-chances, do-it-now kind of approach. And the Speaker Paul Ryan has said that he'd move quickly to get the repeal part passed. And they'll do this most likely through the process called reconciliation. It's a way that the bill was originally passed and does not require 60 votes. So it would essentially defund parts of the ACA by a simple majority vote, more than 50, and that would be essentially the same thing as a repeal, because if the
part is not a repeal,
it's not a repeal, right? It's defunding parts of the law so that they can't actually work.
But it's not a repeal,
right? Because that part to repeal,
it's defunding,
right? To repeal legislation in the Senate requires 60 votes, and so this is a tactic where they can bypass that filibuster that the Democrats would certainly put up if the Republicans tried to outright repeal the legislative part. So if they can defund it by a simple majority vote, that's what we'll probably see happen quickly in February. Also, I think it's likely to see that the mandates will continue in some form. Democrats are unlikely to support any bill without them, because mostly that would mean that millions of Americans could lose coverage, and again, as mentioned before, it would make the pre-existing coverage guarantee hard to maintain. You can't cover sick people if you don't have at least some healthy people paying into the risk pool. And so I think we'll have to see some version of the mandates continue in some form next year. As I mentioned, too, the Medicaid expansion repeal is probably likely, so states that opted not to expand, you can rest assured that's fine, because President-elect Trump has made indications that he'd like to just basically block grant that back to the states and not force an expansion upon states. And we'll probably see also a repeal of the Cadillac tax and medical device tax. Another important point, though, is to note that the exchanges will be struggling. They would have struggled even if Hillary Clinton had won. They're in bad shape. They're fragile. They're not profitable at the moment. Now we have an HHS nominee who has said he opposes Obamacare. So even if Republicans don't repeal or change the exchanges, there's a high risk that they'll collapse under their own weight.
Isn't this a big opportunity for the self-funded industry from the standpoint of these smaller and smaller employers, or even just employers that have joined these exchanges, might look to self-funding or even joining a captive as an alternative?
Sure.
So I think that's an opportunity for our administrators and our audience to gather new business. Based on our discussions, I want to make sure I brought this up before it ended. As many of you know, I talk to CEOs of all of our clients on a daily basis. Every single one of them is talking about adding new groups. They've signed on groups that have never been self-funded before. And I think many of these groups were otherwise either fully insured or on the exchanges. So the more they struggle, the more opportunity there is for the self-funded, community. Sorry about
that. Absolutely. So, I mean, again, the problem is here that the people who signed up for the exchanges are sicker than previously thought. And so they're very costly to cover. And on top of that, the fact of the uncertainty you mentioned before, that insurers are trying to determine whether or not they're going to participate next year. And the rates that they have to issue to the states are due this April. And so if they think that the government's not going to keep in place, for example, the tax subsidies, or they're not going to keep in place the coverage mandates, the insurers aren't just going to keep staying in the exchanges. They're probably going to say, we're not going to sell policies on the exchanges altogether. So it's really a poisonous atmosphere for these insurers that are in the exchanges. And finally, you mentioned last time that already the choices for enrollees in the exchanges is very limited. 57% of exchange enrollees have a choice of three or more insurers in 2017. That's down from 85%. And 32% of counties will have only one exchange insurer in 2017. That's up from 7%. So taken together, all these factors really indicate that the exchanges are going to struggle, and they're really in the death spiral, which I think will continue and accelerate into next year.
Great job, Brady. Ron, try to do better than
that. I don't think that's going to happen.
That's impressive.
Very. I think what we've done, and this isn't particularly news for anybody, but what we've done here is really reiterate what we already know, which is that there is a national misunderstanding of what health insurance is and what insurance is in general, how risk pools work, and how they pay for things. And there's currently a philosophy that insurance carriers have in their backyard money trees growing, the cash comes from the ground, and it's limitless. And as long as we are able to secure insurance coverage for people, all of their claims are paid with this magical cash that comes from the sky. And what people don't understand is that unless you have people paying into the risk pool and not using that money, none of the money will be available to pay for people who are causing more loss than they are paying in premium. That's the way insurance works. The healthy pay for the sick. And the problem here is that the popular portions of the law expand coverage to the sick, expand coverage. Oh, yeah, we want to make sure everyone with a pre-existing condition has coverage. Oh, yeah, we want to make sure that people could be covered late, you know, into their adulthood under their parents' policy. Oh, but we don't want to force people to purchase insurance if they're healthy. So where is the money coming from? And that is ultimately the question. The only way that this is going to work is if either A, funds come from somewhere to pay for the more expensive claims, or B, those claims themselves become less expensive. So either the cost of healthcare itself needs to decrease, or the resources used to pay for healthcare need to increase, or a combination of the two. And I think what you've probably seen today is that much of the dialogue relates to who's paying, how do we find the money, who's paying, and nobody is asking what are we paying for. How much are we paying and why? And I hope that ultimately when enough people ram their heads against the wall and realize they can't create capital from thin air, they're going to turn around and say, we have a budget, there's only so much money in the risk pool, how can we use this money to secure the most coverage for the most people? And anytime you deal with a budget, naturally you have to address what do we spend the money on? What's important? And if something is excessive, you go in and you negotiate and you get the best price you can. And hopefully, even though this is something that, unfortunately, to date, we have not yet seen, no one is really taking the bull by the horns and say, this is the cash we have. What's the most we can get for the least? Hopefully, that's the philosophy we'll start seeing in 2017.
Great job, Ron. So, real quick, for those of you who want to know, our next webinar is going to be January 19th at 1 o'clock, so it's going to be in the new year, so happy new year. And you'll notice over the next 4 months, we have a great collaboration with Dave Chase's documentary film, The Big Heist. We're going to be doing a lot over the next 4 months in regards to this particular documentary, talking about the high cost of healthcare, what we can do, and how we have helped our clients in the past, and just bringing up some outrageous stories. Expect to see those every single Tuesday from one of our staff members for the next 4 months, I believe, as we try a 16-week marketing initiative with The Big Heist. Really quick, we have a couple questions we want to bring up. First, we got a couple of people asking if there's a fee to talk to MARTA. No, there isn't, but if you want to send me a check, you can send me a personal check for about $1,000, and then you can talk to MARTA. I'm kidding. Obviously, all the training regarding all of our reporting portals and tools is free of charge to our clients. We appreciate what you guys do to us. The bottom line is, the better reporting tools we can give you, the better opportunity you have of gaining and obtaining new business away from the big carriers. So, really quickly, Kelly, I have a question regarding gender reassignment. A lot of questions on this. Does the 1557 rule allow a plan the ability to exclude cosmetic services that are solely for improving or altering appearance or self-esteem related to one's appearance following gender reassignment surgery? Really complicated question. You have an answer for that?
Yeah. And it's actually pretty simple. So obviously most self-funded plans have this general underlying medical necessity requirement. That still applies. 1557 doesn't require you to cover things that aren't medically necessary. So in this instance, medical necessity is kind of the basis. And obviously when you apply rules with respect to, you know, pre-certification and determining medical necessity, those obviously have to be applied in a neutral fashion. You have to, you know, tailor your UR and UM reviews to make sure that they're done on, you know, the standards of basis for medical necessity and so on and so forth. So the concept of cosmetic services, obviously there's to a certain extent, you know, it is cosmetic, but if it's not medically necessary, if it's just for, you know, proven appearance, it's not really going to be medically necessary most likely. you know, that generally with respect to these things, you know, the secretary assignments, they are obviously are costly, and they're going to be costly, but it's a process. It's not going, somebody's not going to be able to go to their doctor tomorrow and say, I want to do a sex change. It's a couple year process. They have to go through therapies and they have to go through, you know, different steps to get to that end of actually having the sex reassignment surgery. So there's going to be a lot of chances and opportunities for review of medical necessity along the process. And it's just, you know, take it one day at a time. Make sure that your rules for determining medical necessity are obviously standard and you should be good to go.
One other question that was pretty interesting. I am new to the industry. I don't know what some of the acronyms mean. Trust me, we don't either. We're just making them up. You know, TPA, ASO, IRO. But the question was, is there some way to get a list of them? Do we have something like that? We do, right? We have that in our training program. If Robin, feel free to email us. You go to our slide. Oh, actually, our email's not on here. But email pvcreferral@fegroup.com and ask us that, and we can actually get you a list of what the acronyms are, because we actually, as part of our FIA University training for our staff, it's one of the big things we do. But great, great question. Guys, folks, we ran out of time. On behalf of Ron, Brady, Kelly, and myself, we appreciate you guys all dialing in for the past hour. We hope all of you have a great Christmas, happy holidays, happy New Year, and hope that 2017 is as great and as wonderful and as successful for your organization as it has been for ours in 2016. Talk to you next year. Thanks again.